Welcome to the Enneagrammer. This is my introductory podcast, and I am beyond thrilled to be beginning this journey into the Enneagram, and I'm looking forward to having a lot of fun conversations with very dynamic people in and out of the Enneagram world. I'm going to dedicate this podcast today towards a couple things. The first being a small little snippet of what my journey has been and a little introduction into me and as to why I feel so compelled to tell my story and to continue to teach and bring awareness towards the Enneagram and what a powerful tool it is to understanding our personality and our interpersonal relationships. So I'm going to touch on that for a minute. And then I'm going to tell you a little bit about what I see this podcast and this, you know, effort, aka the Enneagrammer, what I intend for it to do and accomplish. I spend a lot of time thinking about what I spend my time doing. I am a mother. I'm a wife. I have 7 children. 3 of them are grown, but they don't take any less of your time because they're grown. They just it just changes, and they definitely take a little bit less of my physical space and occupy a little bit more of my emotional and mental and heart space. And so I have 4 at home, and anything that I do, there is a give and a take. And the Enneagram has been something that has resonated with me from the time I began studying it. And it actually has taken up some pretty permanent real estate in my life and in the life of my family and my children. They sort of are coming to terms with the fact that this conversation is not going away. So I don't take it lightly that I'm taking your time and I'm taking my time, and I really want to be able to bring something to the forefront of the Enneagram conversation that is meaningful and that is beneficial to people and not just a waste of time. There are a lot of Enneagram voices out there right now. I'm aware of them. I've seen a lot of it. I'm actually very aware of it because it's something that I'm endeavoring and beginning to do. And so I'm kind of seeing what's out there, and I'm getting a feel for what I like and what I don't like, and you know, the type of voice that I want to be at this table. And there's a place for everybody, I'm convinced. The world is a very dynamic and diverse place, and what I say is not going to resonate with everybody, and you know, what other people say isn't necessarily going to resonate with me. And I actually applaud that, and I encourage that, and I love it. It actually really excites me to see that there are people out there in the Enneagram world making humor from it. You know, they create memes, and they create a lot of laughter around our similarities and some of the very obvious attributes that we share as human beings. And in context of the Enneagram, they make funny jokes. And then there's others that are very academic about the Enneagram. There's some that are very religious about the Enneagram, and it's actually part of their theology that they've built into the their curriculum using the Enneagram. So there's a place for everybody. I have my opinions. I'll tell you what those are. One, I believe in my own heart that the Enneagram deserves a place of reverence. I believe that its roots and its history and its intention was to be deeply spiritual. And because of that, I won't be the one at the table making jokes or creating funny memes or all of that sort of stuff. I just really kind of feel like it deserves a little bit more reverence and pause for consideration, because we're talking about pretty meaty stuff. Our lives and our relationships are pretty much central in the way that we will live our life, whether it be for good, better, worse, whatever. How we perform as human beings, how well we know ourselves, and how good of behavior we have, and in consequence, the relationships that we have, is going to be a reflection of that. So I consider it to be an important issue and an important thing, and self-awareness has always been something that has been important to me. I'm kind of this self-proclaimed self-help guru. I have always loved self-help stuff. I've always loved personality things. In fact, when I was a sophomore, I believe, in high school, I had just moved to a new state and had joined a group of kids that were going into the largest high school, I believe, in the state at the time. And I felt really small and like I was nobody. And one of the classes I took was a psychology class where we took the color personality test. And I scored myself, you know, based on the very short test and very short review. And I was a white, which at the time, based on my behavior, was probably very accurate. I was very afraid, probably, you know, coming in as a 15-year-old, not knowing a single soul. There's people, you know, coming into the state of Utah where people have been born and raised together in a lot of cases. They've known each other their whole lives. And here comes this, you know, really mature young girl from Nevada that has experienced a lot of stuff. And in fact, some of my very best friends at the time, it teased me later that they thought I was a narc. They thought I was a grown-up posing as a kid trying to get the down low on what was going on, which just cracks me up. But anyway, it was a tricky time for me trying to figure out where I belonged as a young teenage person. But the color personality test I loved, and it was something that I sought out later as a young adult, and it's something that I've done a lot with my kids and my parents on road trips, and it was just kind of one of those fun little trivia type things. But self-help and self-awareness has always been a central theme in my life, and I'm really grateful for that because, you know, I've been dealt a heavy hand, and now that I'm in my 40s and I'm looking at the last 20 years and seeing, you know, what trauma there has been and what trauma there's been dealt with and not dealt with, and the different crisis that I've had to endure, and my personal self-awareness, understanding who I am, had a big part to do with the success or failure of me overcoming those said traumas or crisis. And then, of course, entry into the Enneagram world a couple years ago has completely transformed my life. One of the questions that I get asked all the time is, what is the Enneagram? The Enneagram is a very old, age-old, some argue hundreds of years, possibly thousands of years old tradition of personality modeling or personality profiling. It is a model to understand the self and others, and it's used by categorizing people into 9 basic types. And, you know, in comparison to the color personalities, there's 4 color personalities. And if you take the test, you know, you find out that you're, you know, 50% one color, and then, you know, maybe you're 25% another color, and then it, you know, you just get smaller. And the Enneagram is a lot like that, where there's a central type that you are, but you're not reduced to that. It's not, okay, this is what you are, and this is all that you are. I've heard it described to me before that the Enneagram, each type is like a color. And if you were to look on the color wheel, for instance, let's say red is associated with the number 8 on the Enneagram. And it is fitting because red in the color personality is the most aggressive number. And 8 on the Enneagram is also the most aggressive number. The wonderful thing about the Enneagram is that there are shades of red. There are everything from a yellow red to an orange red to a kind of a blue red, a pink red. There's just an entire variety of shades and hues and depths into dark and lightness into each of those shades. And that is how dynamic the Enneagram is. So I was having a conversation with my son the other day, and he was saying, you know, he hasn't really dove into the Enneagram, but he, again, my kids are really beginning to realize that this is a conversation that's not going away. It is something that that is a mainstay in my life, and it's going to obviously be a part of our conversations as they continue to grow up and move on with life. I just consider it to be a very, very powerful tool. And, you know, some may decide that it's useful for them and others won't, but they still aren't going to escape the conversations because it's impossible for me to not bring it up in certain situations. And my husband's very aware of it. He's become actually quite astute. He's learning a lot and he understands his type, and we're, you know, starting to kind of understand our kids. They say that you're not really supposed to type children, but when they're your own children and it's coming from parents that have really done their homework, I feel like it's fair. There are some caveats to that. Obviously, you don't want to typecast a child saying that, you know, you're a four, and then they grow up thinking that, you know, they're limited by that type, which isn't the case. We are informed in our life experiences. We are informed by our trauma and our experience and our different crisis. That informs our personality. Our crisis and traumas don't actually become us. Those are just the things that inform us individually. And it's important that we kind of understand that about our kids. That, you know, I have twins, and my twins were born as incredibly different human beings. In fact, when they were first born, we didn't know if they were identical or fraternal. They were in separate sacs, but had a joint placenta. And identical twins can actually be set up that way, believe it or not. They're not always in the same sac, but mine were in separate sacs. And I knew immediately that they were fraternal because I had a spiritual discerning power about their little spirits. I didn't know their personalities. I didn't know anything about them. But people would ask me, are they identical or fraternal? And one of the twins, his face was pretty mashed up. He was the one that was on the bottom most of the time and probably being kicked to death by his twin brother. And so they didn't look alike, but that was just a product of labor and delivery and, you know, being in the womb for so long. They were both 7-pound babies and it was a tight fit. So the only way that I could describe the differences between the two is one was a soggy donut and the other one was a crispy chip. And, you know, that was a mainstay for several weeks. And then it became very apparent that they were actually within a couple of days, it became very apparent that they were fraternal. And if you knew them now, I mean, people don't even think that they're related. We were in a escalator or an elevator the other day in Las Vegas, and you know, it was me and 6 of my 7 children. We had gone there for just a little getaway. My husband was out of town, and this man watched us come into the elevator, and he was just 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. And then he looks at me and he says, 5 and a friend? And he looks at one of the twins. And we're like, no, actually, they're all mine. And my cute daughter, she's like, and there's one more, you know, my married son who wasn't with us. But they're very different people, not only in looks, that has to do with genetics, but just their personalities are different. And Enneagram tradition teaches, there's some debate about this, but mostly it's agreed upon that we are our personalities when we are born. That is our spirit. That is the flavor of our spirituality, of our spirit. And I'm not talking religion. I'm just talking our essence. That's another term in Enneagram language. So we are born the way that we are, and our personalities are informed by our traumas. And, you know, as I look at my life and the things that have played out, that actually is very, very true and is very pertinent in my particular circumstances. So the Enneagram is an ancient tradition, and it has been vetted. It has been cross-examined. It has been put to the test by psychologists and neurosurgeons and, you know, lots of different physicians in the medical and psychological world, and it holds up. There will be some professionals that, you know, have argument about it, and that's fine. There's, you know, to each their own. But I continually to be really, really impressed. And because I'm not a doctor, I'm not a psychologist, I'm not a psychotherapist, none of that. I have, however, had a lot of therapy in my life. I don't care if you come from a stable, beautiful, picturesque Anne of Green Gables upbringing, or you come from Mad Men, like crazy. It doesn't matter. I think therapy is one of the greatest things on the planet. And a really good therapist is even better. I think it helps every relationship and it helps you tremendously. I know people that need therapy so bad, but there's just a stigma around it that they think if I am in therapy, then I'm revealing to the world that I'm flawed. Well, hello, we're all flawed. Every single one of us is screwed up. Every single one of us has been screwed up by our upbringing and our parents and whatever. That is no big deal. That's just virtue of us being humans and being raised by imperfect people. The idea is for that not to create a ripple effect the rest of our life. I was telling a friend recently, I'm like, it is so stupid that we spend, you know, our 20 first years and there's so much growing. I mean, you think about you're born as an infant and you grow and you develop and you grow hair and you grow body parts and all these different things. And by the time you're 20, you have, you know, the rest of your life, maybe 80 years. But those 80 years for so many people are tragically informed by what happened the first 20. And I think it's insane that we give those first 20 years so much power. And, you know, for some, they just move on and they get over it and they just do the best they can with what they've got. But I think for most, at some point or another, coming to terms with the lack that occurred during our upbringing, whether it be a lot or a little, helps you in your life moving forward. It helps you to be a better version of yourself. It carves out some space in your life for forgiveness and for mercy and for grace. And then lo and behold, you become a parent and all of a sudden you're screwing up your kids, obviously not intentionally or deliberately, but we're just not perfect people and we're not going to parent our children in perfect ways. And we're not going to be perfect spouses. We're not going to be perfect siblings. And, you know, I've learned the hard way by doing things the wrong way. And the Enneagram has presented itself in my life as an extraordinary tool to soften those missteps, not only from my perspective, the missteps that I have made in my life, but also recognizing the missteps of the people that are close to me that have the capacity to hurt me. The Enneagram has given me a lot of invitation for grace. And those are things and themes that I really, really want to talk a lot about as time goes on, because I really feel like it's influential in informing your life. So now that you know a little bit about the Enneagram in a really short form, and I've shared with you a little bit about why it's so meaningful to me. When I, you know, began a serious study of the Enneagram, I knew that it would become a mainstay in my life. It just made so much sense to me. And, you know, I felt kind of this panic. You know, I was reading all I could about all nine types, and I was like, oh, I'm a little bit of this, and I'm kind of all of it. And I just wanted to download all of the information at one time because it was exciting me so much that I wanted to fast forward time so that I could just learn all that I possibly could. And I initially landed on the wrong type for me. I initially landed as a type 4. And the reason for that is because I identified really, really strongly with some of the behaviors of a 4. But I did not identify with the motive of a 4. And that was the telltale sign. And that is exactly what differentiates the Enneagram from every other personality, modality, or typology, is that the Enneagram does not test your behavior. It does not necessarily use your behavior to determine your type. And, you know, I hear a lot of personality models kind of use this cliche phrase that it's not what you do, but it's why you do it. And the Enneagram is really the only one that I'm familiar of that really dissects your motives and the why behind everything you do. And that is really the magic of it. It's so complex in so many ways, but so simple in others. And so I spent a few months, you know, really kind of identifying myself with the four, but the more I studied and the more I understood some of the nuances, and remember I talked about the shades, like the color wheel, there weren't as many shades that were like resonating with me within that four type. And I resonated with two, and I resonated with eight. And, you know, those numbers have something to do with one another. And that's something that you'll find is not coincidental in the world of the Enneagram. You know, a couple of my kids, my adult kids, I think I know what they are, but the ones that I also think they could be are numbers that associate with one another. And that's a little bit more advanced Enneagram conversation. If you're new to the Enneagram, that's not going to make a lot of sense. But trust me in the sense that it's diverse, and there are layers of the Enneagram that are more than just your type, your core type. You have wings, which are the types on each side of you. Some people rely really heavily on those wings. You know, I'm a two. That means I'm next to a one and I'm next to a three. I could have behaviors of either of those. And then there's also two points on the Enneagram circle of the nine types that you each number will point to. And they're different for each type. One of those types you go to in stress, and the other type you go to in growth. Though that is beyond amazing. I mean, when I began to see myself as the number that I am, which is a two, and I began to see myself as a four in strength and a four in growth and an eight in stress, I was like, oh my gosh, that's me. You know, the reason I identified so much with a four is because that's where I go in strength. I must be really healthy too. I don't know. Actually, that's not true. It just means that when I'm at my healthiest, I draw upon the energy of a four. And you can go to the high and low side of those numbers. Suzanne Stabile, who happens to be one of my very favorite Enneagram master teachers, she believes and talks quite regularly about the decisions that we make when we are in stress. We don't have to misbehave in stress. That is on you to behave well. And I think that's amazing. And that's a powerful self-governing attribute of the Enneagram, is that you get to choose. And isn't that what self-help and self-awareness is all about? It's just us employing our own agency and sense of discernment in how we want to navigate. You know, I have a lot of people that I know of that when they're stressed, they misbehave. And that's kind of the natural man in all of us. And of course, that when we're healthy, when we're doing really well and there's no stress, we tend to be the best version of ourselves. Well, you know what? I kind of want to be the best version of myself when things are crappy, because that's kind of when I need those energies and those skill sets. And as a two, when I go to eight in stress, eight has some remarkable energy and remarkable personality attributes that I can use to my advantage. So that's just one tiny example as to how dynamic the Enneagram is. So when you find your type, you begin to study your type, and then you begin to study the numbers on each side of you, and then you begin to study the numbers that you go to in strength and in stress. And that will begin to paint a full picture of who you are. A lot of times people will argue about personality models is they don't like the fact that it's reductionary. My son and I were talking about it, and he didn't like the fact that it was reducing him down to a particular type. And it's just not the way it is. My best friend is the same number as me. We're the same type on the Enneagram. we do things different, our behavior's different, but dang it all, why we do the things that we do is the same. Our motives are the same. The very underlying raw realness of what we do correlates. And there's just something really magical about friendships when you are so similar and you see the world from a very similar standpoint, and yet we do things kind of differently. Her life experiences has informed her behavior, and same with mine. But, you know, I imagine it kind of like we're in this room, you know, and if you have ever been in a crowded room and people kind of line the walls of the room, and we're all looking at the same things. We're looking at the same chair and the lamp and that bookshelf and this rug and this end table and, you know, all these different things. But what I can see from the north end of the room versus what someone else sees from the south end of the room, we're looking at the same things, right? Same chair, same couch, but our views are different. The way that we perceive the things are very, very, very different. So that is kind of a way that I begin to absorb how we as human beings see the world in different ways, and yet we're seeing the same thing, if that makes sense. Anyway, so I love the Enneagram. The Enneagram, again, is just a personality tool. It is not, you know, as Suzanne Stabile says, the worst mistake you can make in the Enneagram is to make it more and bigger than it really is. It is not the end-all be-all. The best and the worst thing, according to Suzanne Stabile, is that once you see it, you can't unsee it, and I believe that to be true. I think that once it begins to strum a chord with you and it begins to resonate with you, you really can't escape it. You begin to see it everywhere. And, you know, it isn't fair for us to go about life and typing other people and, you know, making gross assumptions about where people stand, because you really don't know. You don't know until you intimately know their motives. And but it does create an opportunity for understanding. And, you know, you can make guesstimates about people. You know, there are certain personalities in the Enneagram that are very obvious in some regards, but it could also be someone working out of their stress point, and that's very obvious because they're stressed, and so they're borrowing behavior from another type. You just can't type other people very well, and it'll end up, you know, shooting yourself in the foot if you do. So be careful about that. I really, really hope that you continue to listen and support this. I hope and pray that what I bring to the Enneagram table will be a benefit to everybody that listens. I believe, kind of at the beginning of this Enneagram journey for me. There are a lot of really great vetted master teachers that have been doing this for 25, 30 years. I'm not there yet. I'm fairly new, but I've studied diligently, and I'm continuing to study diligently and looking and continually searching for more ways that I can increase my education so that I can be a better asset. So moving forward, I've got some really fun interviews planned. I began this project on kind of this like gut punch inspiration that wouldn't leave me alone. And I thought, okay, I'm going to lean into this a little bit. I've got a lot going on right now in my personal life, but I thought I'll lean into this a little bit. And virtually every person that I reached out to saying, I'm beginning a podcast, this is my new project, it's all about personality and the Enneagram and self-awareness, would you be interested in talking to me about it? There are some that have just a vague understanding of what the Enneagram is, and there's others that love the Enneagram. So you're going to get a little bit of all of that. But to me, it really is irrelevant if my host or the people that I'm interviewing on my show are Enneagram experts or not. If they have self-awareness, then the Enneagram is going to make sense to them. And chances are that there's going to be a piqued interest. But I believe that we have things that we can learn from each other about human relationships and how to navigate that. And, you know, a beautiful part about the Enneagram, one of the things that I fell in love with first, and I mentioned it earlier, was just about the diversity of it, that we come from lots of different backgrounds. The Enneagram is a deeply, deeply spiritual tool, but it is not religious. There's and churches have used it as part of their, you know, religious curriculum, and that's fine because it makes a lot of sense. You know, we in my faith of origin was raised believing that I needed to love one another, that was the second commandment. And I just, you know, as I've grown, I've realized that loving one another is fairly easy. It's liking them that's hard. Liking the people that we associate with sometimes is so hard because we miss each other. We misunderstand each other, and we're just missing the mark over and over and over again. And dang it, wouldn't like this knowledge of the different dynamics of personality, understanding that we're looking at the same room, but you're on the other side of that. And so you're going to see it a little bit differently. And if I understood that, I would give you grace, and I would be I would have empathy towards you because I would understand. But without that knowledge, I somehow get myself in a pickle because I think that everybody's seeing it from my point of view. And that's just not true. And it's just not the way it is. And there's too many millions and billions of people on the planet for that to ever be true. But the Enneagram lays over that. And because it's deeply spiritual, it crosses over into lots of different religious backgrounds, and it doesn't matter. You can be a Jew, you can be a Buddhist, you can be a Christian, and it all works. I've studied that. I've been really intentional about that because I needed to make sure that the Enneagram was vetted properly so that it could integrate into my religious life, my spiritual life, and that it could become part of my spiritual practice. And it has beautifully. And so regardless what religious affiliation you are, it can be a blessing to you. So cheers to that. And, you know, the Enneagram has, my slogan is that it has helped me to learn a better way. And I look forward to the journey ahead. I look forward to the conversations that we're going to have. And I look forward to sharing with you a little bit of my wisdom. I don't have a ton, but I sure have had a lot of life experience. And that lends itself to a constant negotiation in life, how we're going to step and how we're going to coexist with all the people that we have to coexist with and have that be a joyous, beautiful process. So thank you for being a part of this. Thank you for listening today. And I look forward to learning a better way with you. Take care. So this is Jen, and the people that know me best call me Jenny. I have started this new project at a time in my life when the Enneagram has made such an enormous impact on me that I almost cannot contain my excitement about the Enneagram. In doing this project, I have the expectation to talk to many different people. And already I have people lined up and anxious to talk to me, and I just have to kind of get all my ducks in a row. I've got some twin boys that are getting ready to leave the country for 2 years, and that's kind of a big deal. They're serving a mission for our church, and it's sort of where my heart and soul is at the moment. But this Enneagrammer project is something that I also feel very passionately about, and it was pretty inspired when it came to me. And so therefore I'm moving forward with it. And so when I interview people, when I talk to people, I really want them to be able to show up telling me their stories with authenticity and with courage and with bravery and with a lot of vulnerability. And I, as a person on the other side of that interview, want to make sure that all of you know that
I have experienced a lot of the same struggle that you have. And it may be in different seasons of life and it may look a little bit different, but heartache and crisis are things that are universal. And I've had a lot of that. I've had a lot of those sorts of things in my life, and I could spend a lot of time talking about those things. And I'll share a little bit of that with you today. But what I am mostly interested in is talking about the process of healing and what that has looked like for me and why it empowers me every single day to continue to do more in way of learning things in a better way so that I can love people in a better way, so that I can just be a better version of myself. I don't think that there's very many people that wake up and say, I think I want to screw up my life today. I think I want to hurt the people that I love. I think I'm going to misbehave. Yeah, that's what I'm going to do. I am pretty sure that there are very few people that ever have the intention to do it. And yet we do it because we don't know any better. We do things because we just don't know. When I think about the hurt that I've had and the injury to my soul that has occurred by people that are dear to me and close enough to me that they could hurt me, if I think about the different alternatives, the different explanations for those situations, I can almost always come up with one reason, which is that they don't know a better way. And because of that, I'm able to extend forgiveness and I'm able to extend grace and mercy to them. And it doesn't heal the situation and it doesn't make everything better, but it heals me so that I'm no longer hostile. And it gives them the benefit of the doubt. If they were intentionally trying to hurt, then that's still on them. And I don't have any control or leverage over that. So there have been episodes in my life. I have come from a situation where I was the youngest of 7 siblings. My mom has been married several times and divorced several times. My dad died when I was in high school. He suffered from a chronic illness and he had a lifelong struggle with depression and substance abuse. I witnessed overdosing and strange behavior as a little tiny girl, counting up pills on countertops and witnessing my dad passed out. And it was traumatic. And those are influential memories for me. If you think about the Inside Out movie, you know, where they have those core memories, those are some of them. And you carry them with you. And I didn't have control over that. It's just where I was at that time of life. As I got older, I became actually very close with my dad. He got better for a period of time and became a very, very close friend of mine, an emotional confidant. He was very interested in my heart and in knowing me. I felt very seen by him. And the day before my junior year began, he died. And therein lies a whole new set of core memories for me. And in that came different core beliefs and things that needed to be ultimately processed and released from my body. Because at the age of 16, you don't really know how to grieve. You don't really know what mourning is like. You're just kind of uncomfortable with it and you want to get over it and it gets swept under the rug and nobody talks about it. And as long as nobody talks about it, then we're good. But the reality is it was very, very painful for me. And I had an experience about 7 years ago where I ultimately mourned my father. I had a very tender experience where I was going through some of his things, a bucket, a bin full of papers and letters, and which is the extent of my dad's journaling. And I mourned him. I was able to have this tender, sweet moment. In fact, it was over an hour where I just sat in a hallway up in my upstairs rooms and cried, cried and cried and cried. And that had been 20 years since the time he had died. So sometimes we're not able to release and we don't even recognize that we're holding on to things until very much later. So that's one of the things in my life that I've had to really work through. And it happened when I was young and it stayed with me through my adolescence and onto early adulthood and, you know, so on. But when I want to hear stories from the people that I interview, I want to know what their lives were like. I want to hear those things. So I have to be willing to share with you some of the things that I've had to work through that have helped me to become who I am. And the death of my dad is definitely one of those things. Another one of those things that's really helped to define me is my first marriage. I had graduated from high school and went to the first LDSSA activity at the university that I was going to in Salt Lake City. It was the University of Utah. And the LDSSA is sort of a church-organized youth group, fraternity, sorority that has kind of a moral standard. There's no drinking. And so it was a pretty, you know, wholesome activity. I had gone to this party that I didn't really want to go to. I had just broken up with a boyfriend and my friend said, "Why don't you come?" And I was like, "Okay, fine." And so I went and feeling fairly vulnerable and susceptible actually. And the first person I laid eyes on when I walked in the door was my first husband. And it was a very difficult marriage. It was toxic and dysfunctional, and I had never seen what a healthy marriage was supposed to look like. I never had that. My parents had divorced. My mom remarried. That was never a good marriage. They got divorced. Then my mom was single. And I don't blame my mom. Those are the struggles that she's had and had to work through, but I was a part of it. And that was part of my history and my story. So I married him and I wasn't happy from day one, but you don't know what to do when you don't have a lot of clarity. And the nature of the behavior within the marriage made it very, very difficult for me to articulate how I was feeling or what my concerns were. And I began to sort of dissolve as a human being. I had my first child and then I was pregnant with twins, and I was the fourth of seven siblings to conceive twins, but the other three had lost theirs. So when I was pregnant, I was like, "Oh dang, like this is high risk. I'm going to lose these babies just like my siblings did." So at 22 weeks, I was in labor and my doctor said, "You have to lay down or I'm going to put you in the hospital. Like, we're not losing these babies." He knew the family history and all of that. And so we did that. I had a little 18-month-old at the time, and I literally laid down. The only time I could get up was to go to the bathroom and to bathe. And when I bathed, I had to actually like lay down. He didn't even want me to sit. I was on medication to control the contractions. And then before long, I was given a shot to help develop their lungs. And 14 weeks pass and I delivered the babies at 35 weeks and they were 6'3" and 7'5" or 7'3" and 6'5". I'm not sure. About 14 pounds of baby, and they were healthy and beautiful and amazing. And the day that I was to come home from the hospital, we had a car that there was a my husband at the time wasn't working very much and didn't have very much money. We had owned this truck and he had decided to get a title loan on it so that we could make ends meet. I didn't know about it. I had been on bed rest for 14 weeks, just desperately striving to keep these babies alive. And the day that I left home from the hospital, the truck that we had was repossessed by this title loan company. And I was devastated. I mean, that was so devastating. The day that I come home from the hospital, this is the little SUV truck that I was going to be driving with the little kids. We were now down to one car. I was so upset and it was so scary. And, you know, and now I'm dealing with the recovery of birth of twins, and I've literally been laying down for 3.5 months. It was really, really a hard time. But the way that I've always described that era is that my Father in heaven knew that this was not to be. And he cranked up the heat in the kitchen and he made it very easy for the dysfunction to flourish. When somebody's under stress and an exorbitant amount of stress, they misbehave badly. And that's exactly what happened, is the stress of having newborn twins and this little 20-month-old at the time and financial struggles. It was like, it was just more than he could bear. And dysfunction and abuse became rampant. And by about 6 month time, my mom saw me at a dinner that we were having for her. And it was the first time the emotional abuse had actually become physical and public. And we walked away from this family gathering and he was mad at me and he grabbed me by the back of my neck and just squoze so hard I could hardly breathe. And I'm pushing this little stroller with my little babies in it. And he just says mean, terrible words to me. My mom had asked me, she had given me a book called Codependent No More. And she said, you know, do you think that this is your problem? You know, is it your marriage? And I was just like, oh, no. Wonderful marriage. Like, he's the greatest guy. And because he was to the world and to everybody else, he just wasn't to me. So I read Codependent No More and I thought, for sure, this is my life. Like, this is me. I am so codependent. So I found a therapist and she worked primarily with postpartum women. And she had diagnosed I was clinically sleep deprived. We had logged my sleep for a number of weeks. And you start to go crazy at about 6 months with the type of sleep I was getting. So I continued to go to this woman in therapy, and she diagnosed the sleep deprivation. She diagnosed the codependency and then tried to just kind of fill in the blanks. And every time she would try and fill in the blanks, it would be a miss. You know, she would just miss the point somehow. And it just felt like she wasn't translating very well. And so I started searching for another therapist. I found a therapist. I'm 22 years old at this point. And this therapist tells me that I'm in an overtly abusive relationship and marriage, and explicitly explained what was going on. And I didn't believe him. I was like, no. I was in such denial. And he said, I want you to read this book. And I actually already read it once, but he said, I want you to read it again. And I read it, and it was like I could underline every single word that time. It had become very real. I knew the reality of what I was living with, and separation was inevitable. And we worked through some therapy. We were trying to get some other things that had been presented, some addiction issues that had become present during our separation that I didn't know about, that I later found out about. And it was very, very hard. It was not the life that I had dreamt of, because I had come from divorced parents. That was the last thing in my entire life that I would want for my own children. I couldn't even imagine having to share my kids with another person and share holidays. And it was just everything I didn't want. But I knew that I was feeling healthier alone than I was with him. And so rather than be crazy with somebody else, I had to figure out what to do. And I was in my place of worship, which is our temple. I was there every single week for a matter of months. And ultimately, through many things, but that revelation came to me that I had done enough. I had allowed agency to take full sway, and I needed to get out. that the time had come that I needed to move on. And so that's what I did. And that ended that chapter officially. I was a single mom at 23 years old with three little boys and was learning how to recover from a very abusive 4 years. And it was a secret I had to keep for many, many years. The people that were closest to me kind of knew. It became actually a very exhausting topic around my family members because there was so much trauma and disruption with that relationship for many, many years. And it wasn't really until the youngest boys, the twins, were about 12 or 13, that everything that I had done to protect their biological dad, meaning I didn't want my boys to ever have negative feelings about their dad, I had protected that, and I had basically lived a secret as to what the reality of my life was up until that point. And it was like I just got hit in the face with this impression that it was time that I begin to teach them what appropriate behavior is, instead of making excuses for him all the time, because they were beginning to understand things. They were being able to see things. They would ask me, "Mom, why did you and Dad get a divorce?" And my only answer was that we weren't very nice to each other. We weren't very nice to each other. And I would just repeat that over and over again every time they would ask. And they were just smart kids. And they were like, "Mom, we know that's not true. Like, stop saying that. Tell us something." And I really felt prompted at a certain point that it was time that I told them some things. And at that point, I could no longer live in hiding and in secrecy about what my reality was. And of course, I didn't tell them all the things because they didn't need to know all of the things. But it was so hard for me. It was just a very, very challenging chapter of my life.